Okay, so this is joint work with Pablo Perrillo, Federico Spedalieri, and if I get time to talk about it, Barbara Tejal and David Schwab. I'm from Caltech. Okay, so just to give you an outline, I kind of want to give some background to this problem and why we think it's interesting. Okay, so what is entanglement, and what are the sort of weird properties of quantum mechanics that it shows up, and why are people interested in thinking about telling which states are entangled and which are not at the moment. Then I want to sort of outline how to use the machinery that Pablo introduced, this hierarchy of convex relaxations for determining positivity of certain polynomials, how to use that to generate a hierarchy of tests for whether certain quantum states are entangled or otherwise. And then I want to do what I sort of mentioned briefly before, and that is to sort of talk about the duality of this problem, which is the duality of the sort of convex optimization that you end up performing, and to try and sort of physically interpret the objects that have turned up in the theory that we've inherited from the general theory, and to try and sort of highlight some of the kind of general themes that have been pointed out in other application areas in this conference. Okay, so what is entanglement, and what are its weird properties? Okay, so the sort of canonical weird property of quantum mechanics that you that people have been able to write down, and that's sort of quantitative, is that quantum mechanics has actually a rather sort of tenuous hold, if you like, on locality. So let's imagine that Alice and Bob are far separated. They're on the other side of either side of the Pacific Ocean. But they share some kind of system. Now, on the one hand, that could be a classical system, or on the other hand, it could be a quantum mechanical system. And they can perform some number of measurements on their system, and there's some rule which gives probabilities for the outcomes of those measurements. So, Alice can choose to make some number of measurements, and there's some probability, some rule for coming up with probabilities for the outcomes of those measurements. And similarly, Bob has some number of measurements, and there's some rule for coming up with probabilities for outcomes for Bob. Now, if the world was kind of sensible, you might imagine that there were some number of classical variables describing the correlation between Alice and Bob. You know, there's some facts about the world out there that allow you to calculate these probability distribution over variables that have some specific value, that allow you to calculate these probability distributions. And we would like, just as a general principle of physics, for those rules to respect locality. So when Alice chooses to make a particular measurement from the list of measurements she can perform, that shouldn't affect the outcome of whatever measurement Bob chooses to perform. Okay? And if you go away and mathematically write down what that means, that constrains the possible correlations between measurement results here and measurement results here. And so the remarkable thing is that in quantum mechanics, I can write down local measurements. I can write down a description of Alice performing the measurement here and Bob performing the measurement there that violate those constraints. Okay? So I have to give up one of two things. I have to give up the locality. If I want to retain the kind of sensible theory that says that underlying it all there are these things that physicists call hidden variables, there are these actual numbers relating the outcomes of these experiments. If I really insist on having hidden variables, those hidden variables have to be a non-local theory. There has to be something that talks, when Alice decides what measurement she performs, there's some non-locality, something that talks to Bob's system, even though they're infinitely, as far separated as you like, and changes the outcomes of those outcomes of Bob's measurements. If that's an unsatisfactory thing for you, then you should stick with quantum mechanics, because you can retain the locality inside quantum mechanics, but you can't imagine that there are these hidden variables underneath. And in fact, what you have to use to describe your system in quantum mechanics is not probabilities for certain numbers. You have to use matrices. You have to use sort of objects, which I'll talk about in a minute. You have to use quantum mechanical systems. Okay. And in particular, what you have to do is replace, let's say I've got a two-state system. So I'm just going to imagine that my canonical quantum system is some atom. It can be in a ground state, or it can absorb a photon and be in an excited state. And so I can think of this, the classical analog of this, as a two-state system. And so what we have to do in quantum mechanics is we have to replace our two-state system with a vector So this is one basis element of a vector space, this is the other, and the point is that I can be in some superposition, that is some linear combination of these two possible states. And so, if I describe, that's kind of the physical object that I need to use to describe my two-state system now. And what people have realized in the past few years is rather than looking at Bell inequality violations and saying, wow, isn't quantum mechanics a perplexing thing or doesn't have weird properties, is to ask the question, what is it that quantum mechanics is good for? So let's suppose that I take my two-state system and replace it with a quantum mechanical state vector. How then does that affect the resources that I need, for example, to perform some computation? Okay, and so Shor's algorithm shows that there are computations which appear to be able to be solved much more efficiently inside a computing model that has quantum mechanics as opposed to a classical one that has zeros and ones. Okay, so this has some promise to build technology. It's something people are excited about because we're beginning to get the control of real physical systems, which would be necessary to implement this kind of technology. But from my point of view, what's interesting is that you kind of want to get some kind of insight into quantum physics by thinking about quantum physics in a way that... So I'm not going to talk about that, I don't think. I might come back to that. By talking about quantum physics in a way... that by asking questions, which are questions like, so what is quantum physics good for? Okay, so and in particular, a property of quantum physics, a central one, the one which is at the root of Bell inequality violations, is the property of entanglement. Okay, and so that's roughly speaking going to be the subject of this talk. Okay, so let's just sort of talk about the possible quantum, just sort of to cover what exactly an entangled state is from some kind of mathematical and point of view, and try and give you some kind of physical insight into it as well. Okay, so quantum states, I've said that you have to replace your zeros and ones, you have to replace them with vectors, which are linear combinations of zeros and ones. Now that's true, but it's only true insofar as I can exactly determine what state of the system I'm in. So if I don't have absolutely perfect control over my system, I need to think in terms of, classically, I need to start thinking in terms of probability distributions. And the analog of that is just to start, in quantum mechanics, is just to start thinking about probability distributions over vectors. And so the way to do that is to take that information and describe the state of your system as a positive matrix. Okay. So if I've got a two-state system, that I'm going to describe the state of that system as a positive 2x2 complex matrix. Okay, and so I can think of the state as a convex combination of these projectors, and those are my pure states. Those are the vectors that I was talking about before. Okay, so the next important thing is that the state about the structure of quantum mechanics and the reason why this property of entanglement comes up is that. If I've got two physical systems, so this Alice and Bob situation, I need to describe that by a tensor product space. Okay, and in particular, if I've got a product state, if the state of my system this is a situation in which I can be in 0 and 1 here, or I can be 0 and 1 over here, but then I've got to consider the possibility that I'm 1 on both sides. I'm 0 on both sides, I'm 0 on one side and 1 on the other, and vice versa. And those are all possibilities which I can think of as making up this tensor product space. And the point is that quantum mechanically, I can be in linear superpositions of all of those possibilities. So in particular, I can be 1 and 0 and 0 and 1 in some strange combination, which is this superposition. And so this state here is an entangled state. It's a state which violates a Bell inequality of the kind that I described at the beginning. Just to give you a couple more of the rules, I'm going to skip through this. The point is that the dynamics in quantum mechanics, so if I take myself from some starting state to some final state, then there's a map that does that. It has to be a map that preserves the positivity of the states. And so, in fact, I can completely generally say that rho goes to a positive matrix which looks like this. And unitary evolution, that is the evolution you get from Schrodinger's equation that you learnt about as an undergraduate, is a special case of this where there's only one term in this sum and this A is a unitary matrix. And so here I've introduced complex conjugate transpose. Okay, and so I can say that that there are certain constraints on these A matrices. If I take the complex conjugate transpose, multiply it by A, it has to sum up to less than the identity, that is, to a matrix the identity minus this matrix has to be a positive semi-definite matrix. And then this number here, which this guarantees is less than 1, I can think of this as the probability of this state transformation. In this way, so why am I doing these? Why am I coming up with this probability? This is a way of dealing with probabilities in quantum mechanics. Okay, so if I make a measurement on a quantum system, I can just describe that by this matrix, this sum over the A's. The probability there will be a certain number of measurement outcomes such that the probability adds to 1. And the probabilities of all of those measurements are given to me by this trace. Okay. So I can think of these matrices, this thing, I can call it a matrix EJ. I've got a certain number of outcomes, that's probability. The probability is just the trace of this density matrix multiplied by a matrix which describes the measurement. Okay, so that, okay, sorry, this is probably more detailed than you want to know, but the idea is that there is a very simple rule for coming up with probabilities for some kind of measurement outcome. And the point of all of this is that the matrices which describe the measurement are also positive matrices, and that the numbers that we're interested in predicting something physical are the probabilities for outcomes of measurements. Those are just traces, and there's a nice duality here between the things you observe and the things and the objects that you use to describe your states. So this tells you that there's this nice convexity structure of the kind that we've been talking about all along for both quantum states and for quantum measurements. Okay, and there's a physically and the duality that's relevant for this convexity structure is physically important. In physics, we call if we talk about evolution of states, we call that the Schrödinger picture. If we talk about the evolution of observables, we call that the Heisenberg picture. And that duality is relevant because the probabilities for the things we measure are given by this trace. Okay. All right. Fine. Okay. Then the final point to make is that I said before that separated systems have a tensor product structure. Okay, so if I've got a vector here and a vector here, then the tensor product of these things, I can just write it out component-wise in terms of the basis elements of the vector. And what you can see is that actually, although you know we were all told that quantum mechanics is linear, what naturally happens is you get polynomials. Okay, so when you start thinking about separated quantum mechanical systems, you naturally start getting problems with polynomials in them. Final point to make is that local dynamics, that is, dynamics which affect one system and not the other system, I can describe that by operators that act just on, let's say, the system for Alice in the first time. So I can describe dynamics or measurements for one system in terms of operators that just act on that subsystem and not on the whole system of Alice and Bob that I talked about at the beginning. Forget about the reduced density operator. I'll tell you that in a minute. Okay, so the point that I just wanted to make is that because we've got this nice convexity structure, we've got positive matrices both for our measurements and for our states, in some sense, convex optimization is the right tool for a lot of questions that you're going to ask when you ask the question, what is it that quantum mechanics is good for, or what is it that I can achieve with a certain set of resources in quantum mechanics? So the kinds of questions that you're led to ask yourself when you start thinking about quantum computing or quantum communication theory. And so here's just a couple of examples. So let's say I want to transform one state into another with some probability. So you can form those things as semi-definite programs, the kind of optimizations that we've been talking about. Okay. So how am I going to define entanglement? Entangled states are the ones... So what I said was that local dynamics respect this tensor product structure. So the state. So there's a distinction, and it's kind of like a controllability distinction, between the states that I can prepare starting from tensor product states. That is, let's say I have a definite state for system A and a definite state for system B. And then I just perform some action on system A, and maybe I talk over the phone, and Bob, you know, on the other side of the Pacific, does something else to his system, And by doing that, we make up some correlations between our systems, but basically the only set of states that we're able to form are density matrices that have this structure. They're a convex combination of products. So I can write any positive matrix on this tensor product in the form of a sum of products of matrices acting on system A and matrices acting on system B, but in general these coefficients could be positive or negative, right? So the states that I can prepare over the phone on either side of the Pacific, they're the ones that are they're the ones where I can there's some way of making all of these coefficients positive. And the entangled states are simply the ones that I can't perform by such a procedure. And physically, I would have to cross the Pacific, get those systems to interact, and in order to prepare those kinds of states. So the definition of entanglement is basically a definition in terms of the resources to prepare a certain kind of to prepare entangled states. I need to get together and get those two atoms to actually interact directly in order to prepare an entangled state. Okay, so why do people care about entangled states? The reason for that is there's some belief that entanglement is useful as a resource, that there are things that we can do with it. And in particular, I need an entangled state to violate a Bell inequality. And the correlations in Bell inequalities are things which change, for example, the complexity of certain communication tasks in if you start thinking about a quantum communication theory. Similarly, I need entanglement to perform something called teleportation, which I failed to tell you about just now. So basically, it's believed that most kind of quantum information processing tasks, at root, you need to be able to form entangled states in order to perform them. And also, that at root, it's entanglement in quantum mechanics which makes quantum information processing different from classical information processing. Okay, so a question that you would like to be able to answer is, given a density matrix rho, how do we know whether or not it's entangled? Is there some way of doing that, either operationally in terms of a measurement we could perform, or even just mathematically in that I tell you the state rho and you tell me whether or not it's entangled? For pure states, that is for rank one matrices or vectors that I was talking about before, this problem is actually simple, okay? So entangled pure states are easy to distinguish. There's a straightforward calculation you can do. All the entangled states are good for teleportation. All the entangled states violate some Bell inequality, okay? So for mixed states, however, it hasn't even been known how to tell whether or not a given state is entangled. And to remind you what that means, that is, it hasn't even been known how to tell for a given density matrix rho whether there's some way of writing it as a convex combination of product states. Okay. So that's kind of the long intro. How do we go about addressing this problem? And so the first problem I want to address is how do we go about distinguishing, either in an experiment or even just in terms of a mathematical procedure, whether or not a given density matrix rho is entangled? So there's a theorem which is basic. Okay, so basically one thing you might have noticed about my definition of entanglement was that an entangled state was something which I couldn't write as a convex combination of product states. Okay, so the separable states form a convex set. And in fact, there's a very general theorem. So if I want to know whether my given state rho is outside of the separable states form a convex set, and I know for very general reasons that there will be some separating hyperplane. If my state is entangled, there's some separating hyperplane that divides me from the separable states, because the separable states will sort of bulge out in the parameter space. And now, so this is, roughly speaking, the Hahn-Banach theorem. And what is the separating hyperplane? Well, it's an object in the dual space, right? So if this is a state, then Z is an observable. Okay, so it's this duality of quantum mechanics between states and observables. So this separating hyperplane, I should think of that as an observable that I could go into the laboratory and measure. And in fact, what the property that this observable has is that for the in particular state that we care about, it has a negative expectation value. That is, I could go in and measure it, and its average value would be negative. Okay, and that's just because it's on this side of the plane. On the other hand, the thing that you want to be able to show is that if you went into the laboratory and then all of the separable states are on the other side of the plane, that is, they should all have positive expectation values. And so that's what this identity here says. It basically says that for all the product pure states, Z has a positive expectation value. Okay. Now, if I write what this expression just write it out in terms of components in the way that I indicated earlier, what you see is what this is it's a statement about the positivity of a certain kind of polynomial. Okay? So if I want to prove to you that a state is entangled, the way to do that is for you to is for me to tell you about Z. And you have to establish firstly that Z has a negative expectation value for rho. That's easy, that's just some linear computation. But then you have to convince yourself that this is a positive polynomial. Now this is precisely the problem that we've been talking about a lot in this workshop. And so the idea that we would want to have is we would want to come up with a series of easy proofs that given polynomials are positive. Okay, and then to understand what that says, about the states that I can detect using those easy proofs. Okay, so just as a bit of terminology, this thing in physics is called an entanglement witness. That is an observable that you can measure that will tell you that you've got an entangled state. Okay, so I don't want to do that. Okay, so. You now presumably know the story. This thing here, which is the expectation value of the entanglement witness on a product state, I want to restrict to a special form for this function. And in particular, I want to restrict that this thing is, okay, so in distinction to what we've been talking about a lot, these things are complex numbers, right? So I want to, instead of restricting for it to be a sum of squares, I don't have any kind of magnitude on the complex numbers. I need to require, but I do actually have a guarantee that this whole sum is a real number because this thing has to be Hermitian. So that I want to require that this thing here is a sum of squared magnitudes, okay? So there are several, there are polynomials that are real functions of a complex variable, and I'm just requiring that I take the that are complex functions of complex variables, and I take the magnitude squared and add them. Okay, and so what happens if I restrict to entanglement witnesses of this class? So we know that this is the first relaxation. This is kind of assuming that Z is a sum of squares. So we know that there will be a gap between positivity and the property of being a sum of squares. Okay, but let's just say that I've got a given rho, and I want to find out whether or not there is an entanglement witness of this simple sum of squares form. Okay, so that would just be an optimization problem that something like minimize this trace, given that Z is equal to this sum of matrices. So I've just sort of rewritten this condition here in terms of a matrix G and a matrix H, which are positive matrices. And this T sub B corresponds to the fact that here there's a complex conjugate sign for system B. So what I've done is I've actually, the way I can get rid of this complex conjugate, because this is a Hermitian matrix, is I can actually transpose, if I transpose system B for H, then I get an expression which is XYG plus XY complex, XY, that's what this notation means, it means transpose for system B of the matrix H. This matrix is not positive necessarily, but H has to be positive. So I'm sorry, I should actually write out what that... yes, there it is. Okay, so in case that's not clear, this partial transpose operation in terms of matrix elements corresponds to just transposing... So this refers to system A, this refers to system B. It corresponds to just transposing system B. So you see you swap J and L here for L and J here. Okay, so this is an operation which doesn't preserve positivity, but nonetheless it corresponds to a sum of this form for Z corresponds to a sum of squares decomposition for this polynomial here. Okay, so this gives you a semi-definite program. It's actually, it turns out, a trivial semi-definite program to solve. The reason you can see that is because if I substitute Z in here and take the trace, I know rho is positive, so trace of rho times G is certainly positive. And then the next term I have is trace of rho times the partial transpose of H. Now, it turns out that that is equal to the trace of H times the partial transpose of rho. That's just the same thing as the usual identity for transposes inside traces. Now, that tells you that I've got something which is positive time. So this, that second term can only be negative if the partial transpose of rho is not positive semi-definite. Okay, so in fact, I don't need to solve a semi-definite program to actually answer the question of whether there's a Z of this kind. All I actually need to do is perform this partial transpose operation on rho and ask whether or not there are any negative eigenvalues for the resulting matrix. So what we see here is that this first relaxation, this question of whether or not there's an entanglement witness of this restricted class, actually reduces to a thing that you could call the partial transpose test for rho. So this actually was a test which was known before our work, okay? And so this is again this kind of thing that you can, that it's often been possible to sort of handcraft solutions. And in fact, do I have? So I kind of want to show you why that's an easy thing to see. So I'll just go, if we just go back to this definition, if the state is separable and I perform this partial transpose operation, all I do is transpose these positive matrices. They remain positive matrices, so I always get, if I perform a partial transpose on a separable matrix, I always get another positive matrix. So I know that that's a necessary condition for separability. Okay. So that was something which was observed actually in about 96. And what's also known is that there are entangled states in high dimensions, that is, in sufficiently high dimensions, which also which have positive partial transposes, which means they're not detected by entangled states of this restricted class that I talked about. So that in low dimensions, that is, if I've got two-level systems, the example I talked about at the beginning, or if I've got a two-level system and a three-level system, then actually this positive partial transpose criterion is known to be necessary and sufficient. And that's actually due to a much earlier result about positive maps. But in higher dimensions, counterexamples are known, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And so what this, but what thinking about this problem in terms of sum of squares relaxations has given us is it's given us a way to generalize this test which wasn't previously known. That is to create a hierarchy of tests for entanglement which correspond to looking for successively more complicated entanglement witnesses. So another thing to point out is there's been this theme that in some sense, if an observation that's made in other application areas for this kind of work, that in some sense the easy tests should tell you about states that are sort of robustly entangled in some sense. And there's actually some results that are known about this. So for example, so we know that these states that have negative partial transposes, they have easy proofs for entanglement because they have these simple observables that are just sum of squares observables, if you like. Some of the things which are known about this are this process of teleportation, which is a way of using entanglement to sort of magically transfer states of quantum systems from one place to another. Entangled states that have positive partial transposes are not useful for this process, even though it's regarded as an essential kind of property of entanglement. Similarly, there are no known violations of Balin inequalities for entangled states with positive partial transposes. Similarly, there's a process which attempts to extract pure entangled states out of mixed ones. And this is a process called distillation. It's known to be impossible for positive partial transpose entangled states. So in some ways, a lot of the properties that people have learnt to regard as typical of entangled states don't hold for these positive partial transpose entangled states. So in some sense, their entanglement is much weaker than that of the general class. The other one is that it appears that the size of the set of positive partial transpose entangled states is small. There are some results on that in low dimensions, although actually talking about how big the set is, it's apparently not, it seems small in some sense and is not a set of measure zero, but one thing that's known is that for infinite dimensional systems, that is, for instead of having two state systems, I have an actual wave function in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, then these states, these entangled states, which have positive partial transpose are known to be of measure zero. Okay, so that's a sense in which the gap between positivity and sum of squares is very small for large systems. Okay, I'm probably going too fast. Okay, so does anyone have any questions up to there?
Whose result is that last thing, the very last thing?
Oh,
is that the
yes.
Can you send zero?
Yes, so the trace norm, I think. Is that right? Yeah, I think so. That would be the natural thing in the trace norm.
Yeah,
that's in some sense the natural thing because of the way the traces occur. Right. So I should say that these states. Okay, so what I've sort of shown is that there are a set of more exotic than usual entangled states. And I've called them positive partial transpose entangled states because of their relationship to this positive partial transpose test. They're also sometimes called bound entangled states. And the reason for that is this property, that while they're entangled, I can't in some sense extract maximal I can't extract nice, pure entangled states out of them. Now, this is a process called distillation, which I don't want to talk about. But the name bound entangled states is there because I can't distill pure states out of them. And the set of bound entangled states is at least as big as, but maybe larger than the set of positive partial transpose states. Okay. Another point to make is that the polynomial functions that that arise when you start talking about that arise in this problem of entanglement witnesses, you'll recall that they're biquadratic. They're quadratic in x's and quadratic in y's. So they're a very special class of because these are complex variables, these are Hermitian biquadratic forms. So they're a very special class of polynomials that we want to test positivity for or search over the set of. But actually, there's an example that was due to Choi to show that, in fact, there are positive biquadratic Hermitian forms that are not sums of squares. And in particular, I mean, you may or may not be interested in this as an example. And the original proof of positivity was by means of the arithmetic geometric inequality. And so what these semi-definite programming methods allow us to do is to be able to generate proofs in some algorithmic way that entanglement witnesses like that are positive. And so what we actually do in the language of these polynomials is we consider, instead of just considering the polynomial by itself, we multiply by this thing, which is basically the magnitude of the vector x. Okay? So when we multiply by this form, which is also a sum of squares, we can ask whether or not this resulting larger polynomial is still a sum of squares of sum of squared magnitudes. And so this, in some sense, so now if I tell you a state rho, and you want to know whether or not it's entangled, what you will do is you will search over this larger space of entanglement witnesses, and this would be and so I can write this in kind of a matrix language by taking these things to represent matrix element the elements of given positive matrices G, H, and K. And then again, the occurrence of these complex conjugations, I can get rid of them by considering partial transposes. Except now, what I've basically done is I've essentially, instead of getting a system for A and a system for B, I've now essentially got two copies of system A and one copy of system B. And so what actually happens is you can think of this as referring to a physical system, where I've now got a tensor product over three systems. Two copies of system A, one copy of system B, and I can take partial transposes. I can transpose only one system, both for system A and for system B. And so this thing here is something like a general form where I want to minimize the expectation value of this, where Z is a variable that satisfies this equality, where these are all positive matrices. So this is a semi-definite program, and it's just a special case of the general structure that Pablo was talking about yesterday. If the minimum is less than zero, then the state is entangled, and indeed, the semi-definite program will tell us about a Z, which is an entanglement witness for that state. So you can think of this as constructing an observable that you could go into the laboratory and measure, and it would tell you that the state was entangled. And so one of the nice things about this structure is that it allows you to actually constructively come up with observables which determine entanglement. And that wasn't something which was clear before. There was just this general theorem which said that if the state was entangled, there would be an observable that you could measure which would show that it was entangled, but you had no particular way of coming up with that for a given state. Okay, so you can use something like, you can use a semi-definite programming solver in order to test for given examples of entangled states whether or not there are entanglement witnesses of this kind. So we've actually done that. In sort of low-dimensional cases where you've got tensor products, say up to four-state systems, tensoring four-state systems, and there are known examples in the literature, known constructions for these exotic bound entangled or positive partial transpose entangled states, and actually we don't know of an example that isn't detected by the test that I just told you. We have a candidate, but of course the thing is that. This is what we're doing is we're constructing, if you like, proofs of entanglement that are related to these observables, these entanglement witnesses Z. And as you go higher and higher up the hierarchy of relaxations you can do here, the proofs become more and more complicated. So we have one candidate for a entanglement witness for a state which is entangled but is detected by a more complicated entanglement witness. But of course, in that case, it becomes very difficult to prove that the state is in fact entangled. Okay, so just to go back to the Choi example that I had earlier, you can actually apply this machinery and determine that when you multiply by the sum of the xi squared, which I've just written in this form as the length of the vector, you do in fact get something that's a sum of squared magnitudes explicitly, and you can see that you again get terms where you have complex conjugates for the y or for the x, and then some terms, not in that case, any terms that are not complex conjugated. Okay. So of course, this forms a hierarchy. I can multiply, in fact, by any sum of squares I like, and each one of those will create a test for entanglement, which I could implement using a semi-definite program. And the point about that semi-definite program is that for a given k or l, the problem, the semi-definite program I'll get, is something which is just a polynomial time calculation in order to work out whether or not there is an entanglement witness of that class. And the thing that we can show, which I'm not going to be able to go over, is that I actually don't need to just forget about this term, just make k sufficiently large. So we just need to multiply by the sum of the xi squared to some power. If the state rho is entangled, then there will be some power k for which I will construct an entanglement witness of this special class, where the left-hand side is equal to a sum of squared magnitudes. On the other hand, it's actually so what we've created is a sequence of kind of easy tests. On the other hand, Leon Gurvitz has proved that in fact the problem of distinguishing separable from entangled states is NP hard if you scale the dimension of the systems that you're considering. So if I use as my systems my problem size parameter the dimension of the systems that are entangled, then that's an NP hard problem. So that again, this has the sort of the general structure of that even though we're considering here a restricted class of polynomials, they're sufficiently complicated that it's in fact an NP-hard problem to solve. Okay. Right. So any questions that far? Okay. So what I've described here is that I've described the. This hierarchy of tests in terms of a hierarchy of search algorithms that search for a certain observable, and we're in this kind of general setting of positivity of polynomials, I'm searching over classes of polynomials that are in fact sums of squares. When I write that down as a semi-definite program, okay. So the general form of a semi-definite program, just to remind you, is that is over here. I've got some optimization over a positive matrix. So this matrix W is a variable. I'm restricting its positive. So remember those each of those terms in that sum of squares I had before. I had G, H, and K matrices had to be positive. They had to satisfy certain trace constraints. And then I wanted to maximize some function, which was basically to do with rho. Okay, so I want to think of this search over entanglement witnesses as the dual of a semi-definite program. And what I haven't told you about is, you know, what is the primal problem? So this primal problem is also, of course, some optimization. The variable here is the vector of coefficients w, and I'm looking for a value of w such that this is positive, and I want to minimize this function, which is to do with the constraints of the primal problem. So recall that I said that the duality in the convex optimization is the same as the duality between observables and states. Okay, so that here we're looking for an entanglement witness that is an observable W. On the other side, then I expect this linear combination of matrices, I expect that to be a quantum state. The other thing was that you said that, you remember that I said that when we go to these higher order tests, we multiply by the sum of the Xi's, it's as if I've got a second copy of the system A. So I expect these states to live in a larger system, that is a system where there are two copies of A and one copy of B. Sorry about that, okay. So it is indeed the case that I can envisage, I can give that kind of interpretation to the primal semi-definite program. So I've actually drawn three copies of A here. So this would be the third in the hierarchy of tests. And so the thing is that it's a fairly simple property of separable states. So we recall that a dense matrix rho is separable if it can be written as a convex combination of products. Then it's fairly straightforward to see that I can now, so this notation here just means that I've got S copies of system A, and on each copy of system A, I've got an identical state. Okay, so instead of just having a system of A and B where the shared state is rho, I now have, let's say, three copies of system A, but the shared state on each pair A and B is still rho. Now, a technical way of saying this is that I could average over, let's say, these two copies of A, and I could recover the state rho on these two states, systems. Similarly, I could average over these two and, again, recover rho on these two systems. It doesn't matter which one I leave behind. So a kind of mathematical way of writing that is that for any separable state rho, I can come up with a state rho tilde, and it has this property that again, it's a convex combination, it's still separable, but it has identical states on each of the copies of system A and correlated in exactly in an identical way with the state on system B. So that means, and you can say mathematically what you mean by this, the state of any copy of A and B is in fact rho. We call that the reduced state. If I sort of average over these two things, I get a reduced state. That is rho. I recover rho. Similarly, this system here, I could take partial transposes. I could transpose any of these factors of A or B, and I could recover a state that was still positive. You can kind of see that for the same reason. So if the state is separable, then I can construct a rho tilde, which has this property that the state of any copy of A and B is rho, and it has all positive partial transposes. And it turns out that I can, if I write down as a semi-definite program what it means to search for, okay, so the fact that this averaging property, the property that the state of any copy of A and B is rho, that's just a finite series of trace constraints on this matrix rho tilde. Similarly, the positivity of this matrix and the positivity of its partial transpose, that's just a finite series of positivity constraints. So I can write down what it means, and don't worry about the details of this, I can write down what it means as a semi-definite program to search for a state with these properties, it's a state rho tilde. And it turns out that this is precisely the dual program to This is precisely the dual program to the problem that I wrote down at the beginning, the problem of looking for an entanglement witness with a certain algebraic structure. Okay. So that means that when we run this semi-definite program, we get one of two eventualities. On the other hand, on the one hand, if we get a negative expectation value, we've constructed a negative result to the optimization. We've constructed an entanglement witness. That is a short proof that the state we've got is entangled. We could go into the laboratory and, in principle, measure that observable. On the other hand, let's say that we fail to prove that the state is entangled, then we construct one of these state extensions. So one of these states on a larger system with some number of copies of A and system B that has all of these positivity properties. And that in some sense is telling us that it's quite likely that the state is actually separable. Okay? It doesn't give you an explicit decomposition in terms of convex combination of product states. But it tells you that the state is quite likely to be separable, and one motivating reason for that. Is to come back to this Bell experiment. So I've said that we can interpret this primal problem in terms of creating states on a larger space, and they have this property that in some sense I can have an identical state be shared between any number of copies of A and system B. So whenever I average over some number of copies of system A, if I've got the state rho tilde, I get my density matrix rho back. Now, it's actually interesting to note that if the state is a pure entangled state, there is no state of this, there is no rho tilde, right? So an extension rho tilde cannot exist if the state is a pure entangled state. So even the existence of a state like this has to be a very mixed state. It's a surprising property for an entangled state to have. But to give you just a further concrete reason why it's a surprising property for an entangled state to have, is that if we go back to this Bell experiment. So I said before that one of the sort of central quantitative ways in which entangled states are strange and surprising from some kind of classical perspective is because they violate this classical intuition. You can't come up with sensible hidden variable theories for entangled states. And indeed, if it's a pure entangled state, it's going to violate some Bell inequality. And so a thing that we've been able to show in collaboration with Barbara Terhal and David Schwab is that you can consider these state extensions, that is these states on some number of copies of system A and system B, as local hidden variable theories. That is, you can consider them as sensible theories of any kind of measurement that you could make, any kind of experiment that you could perform of this kind. That is, that if a state extension exists, then there is also a local hidden variable theory, that is a probabilistic description of an experiment of this Bell kind. That is, where Alice has some number of measurements that she can choose to perform with some number of outcomes, and Bob has some number of measurements to perform with some number of outcomes, and you can write down a hidden variable theory where Alice's choice of measurements doesn't affect the statistics of Bob's outcomes. And in particular, the number of measurements that you're able that you can allow Alice to have is exactly the number of copies of system A. So I can actually imagine a sort of a thought experiment in which Alice makes the first of her measurements on the first copy of system A, the second of her measurements on the second copy of system A, and the third of her measurements on the third copy of system A. And then this property that if I average over the excess copies of system A, I get the same state back. That guarantees that the statistics of all of those measurements are the same as if Alice and Bob had actually been performing this experiment on system rho. And then what you notice is that actually those are sort of now completely independent experiments acting on completely different physical systems. One thing I haven't told you is that this property of violating a Bell inequality experiment, these measurements need to correspond to traces over matrices that don't commute. Okay, so you only get a violation if those matrices are not commuting. And in this case, now when we've replaced the okay, so I need, uh, dot, dot, okay, so So in the situation where we imagine this thought experiment, where Alice performs experiment one on the first copy, experiment two on the second copy, and experiment three on the third copy, then the operators which describe those measurements act like the identity. So the operator which describes the first measurement has some non-zero value on here and acts like the identity on these pairs. And similarly for the other ones. So all of those matrices which describe those measurements, they all commute. And so it's actually easy to work out that they don't violate a Ballin equality. Now, so that wasn't enough for you to see that in detail, but the basic idea is that I can imagine, I can conceptualize these extensions which are generated by the primal problem. I can conceptualize them as things which tell me that this state has very classical properties, and specifically that this state is a quantum state for which there's no Ballin equality violation for any experiment where Alice has three measurements she can perform, and Bob in fact has any number of measurements. Okay. So I think that that's entirely enough. So just to summarize what we've done here, on the one hand, by applying this machinery of semi-definite programming relaxations for positivity, we've been able to extend the previously known test, so that was the positive partial transpose test, for entanglement to actually a whole hierarchy that's complete. Okay, so we're able to show that by looking at this hierarchy, if the state is entangled, then at some point you'll be able to construct an entanglement witness of this kind for it. So the other thing is that by inspecting the primal and dual forms of the resulting semi-definite programs, you can show that these tests amount in some sense to looking on the one hand for observables that prove that the state is entangled, for looking for entanglement witnesses that have certain special structure, and on the other hand, to looking for local hidden variable theories for those states. That is, looking for demonstrations that you won't find a Ballin equality violation for that particular state rho. Okay. So where could you kind of go with this stuff? Just one idea of a question that I haven't told you anything about, and that's actually kind of completely open, is that basically I've given you some way, given a density matrix rho, of trying to work out whether or not that state is entangled. Okay. But another question that might be interesting, or that certainly is interesting, is given a state rho, do you know whether or not it does violate a Ballin equality for some number of settings for Alice and some number of settings for Bob? And that is there some experiment on that state that violates local realism? And actually, there is essentially nothing known about the set of states that violate local realism, or even really prior to this kind of work, about how to construct local hidden variable theories that would prove that a given state rho it has some local realistic description for experiments on it. So this work provides some hope that you can characterize both the set of local hidden variable theories and the set of states that violate local hidden variable theories. Similarly, you might ask, and I know I didn't talk about teleportation, but so teleportation is another commonly talked about property of entangled states, but again, we don't know exactly the set of states that are useful for teleportation. And in particular, one thing that you might want to claim is that these mixed states that aren't useful for teleportation, that apparently don't violate local realism, you might not want to call them entangled at all. Specifically, you might want to come up with a definition of entanglement that was in terms of what it was good for. That is, a definition of entanglement that related directly to its properties as a resource, rather than relating to the resources which are required to prepare the state. Okay, so our current definition, the definition in terms of convex combinations of tensor products, basically relates to the resources which are required to prepare an entangled state. And on the other hand, we actually know that entangled states are useful for something, but the set of states which are really useful, that is the set of states which, for example, violate local realism, or the set of states that are useful for teleportation, we don't have good characterizations of those sets. So an interesting direction for future research is to really try and understand those better, and to actually maybe understand whether or not they correspond to the set of states that have, for example, negative partial transpose. That is, whether the test for entanglement that you really want to perform is the one which corresponds to looking for entanglement witnesses that are sums of squares, rather than looking for entanglement witnesses that are positive. Okay, so I've talked altogether too much. Thanks very much for your attention. questions.
Can you say something about the, I mean, are there other ways, you said something at the end about these local human viral theories.
Right.
I mean, do you know, that kind of gives you, in a sense, you know, a lower bound, like an upper bound.
Right.
Big things, something there, of these very early instruments, maybe even more strong in human viral theories.
Right.
Do you know anything about other kinds of
I know of only one other construction of a local hidden variable theory. So the paper that initially pointed out what you wanted to mean by an entangled state and what you wanted to mean by a separable state for mixed states was a paper by Werner in the late 80s. And in that paper, he constructs explicit local hidden variable theories for a class of entangled states that are very highly symmetric. So it's a sort of it's not at all an algorithmic construction. So this is the only other construction that I know of. They're similar but not the same. So for example, I can use this to construct local hidden variable theories for some of the states that he does, but not all of them. So it appears that his construction is not the same as ours.
So to just kind of recap the last couple of days, one conjecture that we have that seems, I don't want to claim it's universal, but it comes up enough that it's interesting, that we often start out with problems where we think what we want to show boils down to positivity. Over and over again, we've seen this positivity will come up. And then we replace that by something that involves some squares. And often after we think about it a while, it turns out that maybe the sum of the squares test isn't just an approximation of the positivity test, but actually something in its own right is interesting. And perhaps more interesting or more useful than the actual positivity test itself. So there's two ways to think about that. One is that the gap between positivity and sum of squares is, as I suggested yesterday, potentially just an indication of the fragility of the question you're asking. But there might be a stronger version of that, which is that often it's the sum of squares test that is in fact the test that is physically most meaningful, or from the engineering technology point of view, most meaningful. And so these are all just, this is very unresolved. I'm not claiming that we have anything more than sketches of this, but one thing you want to maybe talk about a little bit tomorrow on the math side is what some of the other mathematical evidence there is regarding this gap between sum of squares and probability. Because now it becomes a central question. I mean, you see this coming up all over the place. The gap between sum of squares and probability being a really central question. It's interesting how it turned out here. I mean, I think it's interesting how rich it is in connecting up with issues of teleportation, quantum entanglement, and these local hidden variables. I don't claim by any means to understand it, but it's interesting just how it pops up there. We already have experience in the area of robust control with how it connects up with the difference between uncertainty that is assumed to be, the gap between the uncertainty that's assumed to be time invariant or arbitrarily slowly time varying, which you might think wouldn't be any different, but it is different. And there's a gap there. And you wonder, when I mean time invariant, do I really mean time invariant or arbitrarily slowly varying? And it's actually, you might think that the arbitrarily slowly varying is what you actually really mean by time invariant, and there's a gap there, and that gap happens to be, in that context, related to the gap between sum of squares and positivity. So there's a lot of, this is a very rich question, and I think we're just getting the tip of the iceberg with respect to this
question. Yeah, I should say that also, so we know that the set of states that are useful for teleportation is contained in the set of negative partial transpose states. And similarly, it appears that the set of states that violate Balanon inequalities is contained in the set of negative partial transpose states. But I don't know that it goes to that boundary. And
So there's a duality between the observables and the states and the dual problem and the primer problem. I mean, is that directly from the mathematical mapping that you perform?
That's to do with the fact that you describe your quantum systems by positive matrices, and you describe the probabilities of measurement outcomes or the expectation values of measurement outcomes as the trace of that matrix against some other matrix, some other Hermitian matrix. So that the fact that what's physically relevant is those probabilities means that there's this natural duality between those two matrices. And so, you know, in sort of traditional quantum mechanics, you can propagate either of those states or those observables, and those are just completely kind of equivalent ways of proceeding. And so that duality comes because, you know, what's interesting is these convex objects.
But is it just fortuitous that the dual problem, primary problems were constructed in the same way as the duality was set up for quantum mechanics? Was it motivated? Because, you know, you can think people are motivated by what has been done before, and that's why they decided to construct a dual problem, because...
Right. I'm not sure what the right answer to that question is. But I mean, in some sense, when people write down, I mean, so it goes back to the fact that the duality in quantum mechanics and the duality in semi-definite programming are the same thing. And so in some sense, when you're talking about positive matrices, taking traces of things is kind of the sensible thing to do. And it's the sensible thing to do not just in quantum mechanics, but in other areas, which is kind of where you get that semi-definite programming duality.
So I see you're sending this hierarchy, you keep getting negative results.
Right.
With this, you just have to keep going.
Unfortunately, at the moment, you do. So that's another open thing that I should have said. So, for example, there are several kind of natural conjectures. That is, we know that this positive partial transpose test is everything you need to know in low dimensions. That is, for two-state systems, tends to two-state. And so, a natural conjecture, which is kind of supported, but certainly not proven by any stretch by our numerical evidence, is that in low dimensions, the first of these tests is sufficient. And so indeed, the only candidate we have for something that's more complicated is in a pretty high dimension. So you might hope that there's some kind of guarantee about how high you need to go, but this complexity result tells you that would be something which grows in a nasty way with the dimension of your Hilbert space.
I mean, that's high. Okay.
Yeah.